back to Barrel Horse World. I'm Cassidy Teague, and this is the first episode of our Fall 2022 series of Building a Breeding Business on Barrel Talk Radio. Tonight, our special guest is Bill and Deb Myers of St. Orange, South Dakota. They will give us insight on their successes and failures and share with us the lessons they've learned in becoming legendary breeders and give us tips as we head into the upcoming breeding season. So let's get started. Welcome, Bill and Deb.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you guys for joining us this evening. We're so excited. Of course, everyone knows and admires the legendary Frenchman's Guy, but let's just get started by talking about your background, each of you, and just all the experience and different disciplines of knowledge you guys have, and how you guys got started.
You want me to start? Okay. Yeah, you know, we both, Deb and I both grew up loving horses, and so I grew up in a ranching background, and Debbie grew up, her folks were auctioneers and in the livestock business, so we both had ag backgrounds, and we just, like I said, we both grew up kind of horse nuts. I loved roping and the Western stuff, you know, rope calves and team roped, and started out doing that in high school rodeo and stuff like that. And as we both got older, we moved over into the amateur rodeos and finally the pro rodeos, both of us. And so that was kind of where our interest come from in the horse world is the Western world. I grew up, my uncle was a great horseman, and he instilled in me about how to put a handle on a horse and how to make a good stock horse, work a cow, and just taught me a lot of the basics of training good horses when I was a kid. And I was ate up with wanting to do it, so nobody had to push me. I loved doing it, and I lived and breathed it when I was a kid. And Debbie was the same way, I think, and I'll let her talk about it, but she was a horse nut too and loved barrel racing and anything to do with a horse. I mean, we both if we could ride a horse, we were happy as far as just growing up. And then as we got older, and finally we got married, when we both were out of high school, we got married. We grew up in a town called Fort Pierce, South Dakota. Real rich in Western history. You know, Casey Tibbs is from there. And there was a lot of Western influence there in that town we grew up in. And so we decided we wanted to make our living in the horse business at a point. And so we started out and we worked together, broke colts, a lot of colts, and eventually got to kind of got pushed into the racehorse training business early on in our careers, and did that for approximately 10 years. Trained a lot of really nice racehorses in the five-state area up in where we lived, and went to the tracks and enjoyed that. Learned a lot of stuff from the racehorse world, you know, from confirmation what we wanted for, you know, we've seen the work soundness wise, you know, old bloodlines that we got knowledge of from running them type of horses, and we gained a lot of knowledge in the racehorse world that we took with us after we kind of left the racehorse world. And, you know, we'd train racehorses in the summer, and then we'd come home in the fall and go back to riding performance horses. And we roped on a lot of the horses that people sent to us to train, you know, that when they quit running them, we'd rope on them, or Debbie would work them on the barrels, and we'd convert them over back into the performance horse world. So we did that, both of us, you know, we're pretty much equal as far as the amount of time we did that direction. And it seemed like there was some other things that happened along the way that caused us to get into the cutting horse training, the rein cow horse training. We did that for a few years also, kind of after we quit the racetrack. Loved that. Learned a lot of stuff there also that we've helped, or that has helped us put our whole program together, because we, you know, took out some out of all of that stuff to finally raise the kind of horses that we wanted to raise. And actually the bloodline that we have, the French guy himself, we learned about that at the racetrack. They was running, you know, full sisters to his mother, and they were beautiful mares. They were good minded, and they were really, I guess they attracted us to them mares. And so we got to pursuing that bloodline of a horse as we finally decided to get into the breeding business. That was a bloodline that we'd followed and studied and, you know, seen the results of that bloodline. And that was like I said, we incorporated that bloodline into the horses that we have today.
Absolutely. So you take a lot of different disciplines, rodeo, racetrack, cutting horses, reining cow horses. You said you did snaffle bit. So what a broad range of skill set you both had coming into the barrel horse program.
And actually, Lord Alamedus was the horse that really, really got us, and I'll just tell you, sold us on that bloodline of horses, because we bought him as a yearling. We raced him on the racetrack as a two-year-old. He would have been a half-brother to Frenchman's guy. He was out of Frenchman's lady, his mother. And he
was
out of
his son,
Lord Alamedus.
Okay.
He was out of a horse called Liege Lord, which was the son of Alamedus Bar.
Okay.
And out of Frenchman's lady, the mother to Frenchman's guy. So when we bought him, we raced him as a two-year-old, and he won the South Dakota Bred Paternity as a two-year-old gelding. Took him to Casper, Wyoming, won with him over there, and we didn't start him very many times, but he was an extremely talented horse with an unbelievable amount of brains, and we showed him in his rain cow horse later on as a three-year-old, placed on him in that, took him to the cutting horse pen when he was four with very little knowledge of how to do that from on my side of the deal. That was around a good friend of mine that helped me a lot, but still had not had a lot of experience in the cutting horse world. So the horse, you know, he was so good that he kind of took care of me. And then as a five-year-old, he won in both. In there was two different cutting associations in South Dakota. He won the year-end classes a couple novice classes in both of them as a four.
Wow.
As a five, we took him, and Debbie was pregnant with our first baby that year, so she couldn't ride him. So we sent him to a gal by the name of Gail Beebe, and we took him. He only had 3 months training, but he, you know, was extremely broke from what we did before that. And he only had 3 months barrel training, and he went and won five out of six barrel fraternities we took him to.
Wow.
Yeah, up here. So, and he was second in the other one. So he won a lot of money. He was an amazing horse. So, and we end up selling him to Martha Josey for a lot of money at that time, back in the 80s. So that horse right there was the horse that really, really established what we wanted to do in raising horses, because he was so good at so many things, and he was a pretty horse. He had beautiful movement. He was a classy horse, you know, real pretty horse. He had all the attributes that we wanted to have in a breeding program.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So how did so his mother is the same, obviously, Frenchman's guy's mother. So how did you acquire Frenchman's guy?
Excuse me? I couldn't hear you there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said, so that Frenchman's guy and him had the same mother. So tell us how, after that, you figure out you love this horse. So how do you acquire Frenchman's guy?
Okay. Yeah, that's easy, because so after that horse right there, we went back and we bought the colt out of that mare every year after that. We had a full sister and a full brother to him that we bought as baby colts, and then we broke them and trained them and sold them. They made phenomenal horses, and we were struggling financially in them days, and whenever we got one really, really good like that, somebody would want to buy them from us, and we got really good money for them horses back at that time. So finally, the last horse that we got out of the old mare was Frenchman's guy. And wow. So the family that owned that mare, the Loises, then their family kind of went to, there was a couple, two or three more after that that we couldn't get because the family wanted them. But, mm-hmm. but he was, we owned brothers and sisters to him before we owned him full brothers and sisters that were really, really great horses also. And they just made it solidified the fact that, you know, yeah, that's the bloodline of horses we want. Mm-hmm. And we actually didn't even buy him for a stud. We figured we'd probably just, train him, do the same thing we did with the other ones, you know, sell him at some point. But okay. He lost his eye. He lost his eye as a yearling in a stall accident. And so we turned him out and was pretty, you know, depressed over the deal because we thought, well, we at that time we give a lot of money for him for a colt. And, we yes. thought, well, son of a gun, now there goes our chances of, you know, turning him into a profit. So we yes. turned him out for 2 years. Got him back up. I just turned him out in the pasture at a neighbor, a friend of ours. Got him back up and broke him. And he only had one eye, of course. He had lost his right eye. So we broke him, but he was so amazing when we broke him that we decided, jeepers, we need to try to turn this deal into something. So we went ahead and we got him really well broke, and we took him to the barrel fraternities when he was five. He placed in a couple, two or three barrel fraternities. And then my wife had a really good barrel horse at that time that was a three-quarter sister to him by the name of PC Lady Francis that she was running at the rodeos. Well, yeah. And finally, she kind of got to the place where we was needing to retire her, so Debbie picked up and started running Frenchman's Guy. And like she when she finally started hauling him to the rodeos, she won five of the first seven rodeos she went to on him. And wow. won like the five state area up here, she won very consistently on him. You know, it's not recorded because they didn't even keep track of stuff back then, but he was really, really a tough barrel horse. And so then, you know, another, I guess, blessing that helped us with his career was that Bozo was just starting to be a nationally known, very famous horse. Mm-hmm. And of course he was a three-quarter brother to Frenchman's Guy. Mm-hmm. So that horse really helped the popularity of Frenchman's Guy get off the ground as a breeding horse. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how that all happened.
How incredible! So you had multiple half brothers or half siblings, and then full yes. siblings before you ever got Frenchman's Guy. Then he gets in the stall accident as a yearling, so you think it's over, and then you got him back up, and he had overcome so much.
Say that again, Cassidy.
I said he overcame the stall accident. And all that, and he had overcame so much. And then when Deb got on him, it was just instant success.
Yeah, pretty much. He was very sensitive. He's very smart. He was, you know, like Debbie with his first barrel where he only had one eye. She yeah. had one of the prettiest first barrels you ever seen, but he listened to her really good. Like when she'd sat, he would just, you know, drag his butt and turn, and he kept really good form. He had a lot of responsiveness in his face and his sides. And she was able to, perform at a real high level on him right away. He was a real amazing horse for a horse with one eye, for sure.
Right. How did he compare to the other siblings you had had?
You know, he was real. I would say he would be real similar to him. How did he compare to these other brothers and sisters? Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of similarity in all of them, a lot of consistency in the brothers and sisters in him. And I guess, like I said, that's why we got so sold on that bloodline of horses. They were all real, real confident horses, hard trying horses, learned extremely fast and easy. Mm-hmm. And they all had that, not just him. He was, I wouldn't say he was any better than any of them, really. I mean, He, other than the fact that he only had one eye, you know, so you'd have to say with that obstacle, he, he overcame that, and you got to give him a lot of credit for that, you know.
Right. So the mother, Frenchman's lady, she was by Laughing Boy. So was it the Laughing Boy you were after in that bloodline?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that was a real old bloodline. You know, Laughing Boy was actually a half brother to Doc Marr. He was out of Lightning Bar. Mm-hmm. And then his mother was a daughter of Jill Reed II. But Laughing Boy came up into South Dakota in probably the 60s, and he come from Tucson. He was raised in Arizona. But he sired some really, really great racehorses up here, and he was a great broodmare sire. Mm-hmm. A lot of prettiness, a lot of, you know, like I said, they moved amazing. Mm-hmm. He was a phenomenal maternal sire, Laughing Boy was. And right. He had lots. We trained some Laughing Boy mares that we ran when we were off the track, and then we trained some colts out of Laughing Boy mares that were really great racehorses. And that horse right there is what we probably like the most about his bloodline.
Right. And Deb, this is a question for you. What did he feel like? Just, you know, as a barrel horse trainer and lots of jockeys and trainers listening, what did he feel like? Just give us an idea.
Well, for one thing, and I didn't even realize it at the time, but like Bill said, I rode a three-quarter sister to him. And then when I started riding him, they both had so much confidence. I mean, when you walk in to make a run, you just had confidence because they had so much confidence, and it
right.
was so easy for him that sometimes he would get frustrated because he might switch leads two times between the first and second barrel. It's like, no, we don't need to do that, you know. But he was awesome. He had that low knee action and that long reach that one of the things that we wanted to keep in our program once we got him as a sire. But he just had so much confidence. His sister was the same way. They just, I mean, you just didn't think you couldn't do it because you were pretty sure they knew they could do it, you know. And I didn't realize that wasn't an everyday deal on all bloodlines because I just rode her and him for so long. But, I mean, that was probably what I liked about him most. That and it was so easy for him. I mean, just, you know, just so easy. And I think that's another thing about his colt that helps in their mentally, because physically it's so easy for them that mm-hmm. it never stresses them mentally. So
right.
they don't get frustrated and they don't get tight, you know. And you know that barrel horse has to be, you know, relaxed in their turns, and it's so easy for them. It's just the same way with the smooth guy. It was the same way, you know, things are easy for them. So
right.
it's not hard on him mentally, much less physically.
Right.
But he was, I really miss not hauling him after. He got so busy in the stud pen. And back then it was, we didn't even have him trained to the dummy. We were still live covering and live collecting, Bill and I, which is a whole nother funny story. But, we didn't have a dummy. We didn't. They hadn't allowed ship semen yet back when we first started with him. So mm-hmm. it got to the point where I'd get up in the morning and breed a mare, and then I'd go rodeo, come back at night, breed a mare, get up the next morning, breed a mare. I mean, nobody wanted to travel with me because I was backtracking a lot. But,
wow.
I mean, he just did it, you know. So
wow.
he was really cool to ride and so well-mannered. I mean, I definitely was very lucky in that situation, because he just, I mean, I hauled him with mares, I hauled him with geldings. He was very well mannered. The only thing I had to watch for was to, you know, not have people ride on the side where he couldn't see him, because that would make him
right.
a little nervous. But as far as hauling him with everything, he was awesome. His personality and his, he just was really a great horse to haul.
I think everyone probably would expect you to say that just from what we know about his offspring, you know, so well known for their amazing minds and trainability.
Oh, they have great, I mean, and Smooth Guy got that from his dad and his mom both. They're just such, I mean, they're good with kids. They're good with everybody. They just like people.
So in regards to Smooth Guy, how would you compare him feel wise to Frenchman's Guy?
How would we compare him, you said?
Yeah, just when, you know, riding them, did he feel like Frenchman's guy?
You know, they had a lot of the same similarities. Smooth guy was probably built just a little thicker. And so you probably feel a little more power in him, but not much. Frenchman's guy was awful strong horse too. But probably that's about it. You know, they were both, you know, as far as handling them and showing them things and doing stuff with them, they were very similar.
Very good.
I know that people have had, the only comment I've had probably negative, one of the negative comments about guy was, people would say, well, they just think too much. These colts think too much. And we always said, well, we kind of like that about them. But they did need any drilling, you know. Show them something once or twice and they get it. And then you move on and do something else. Otherwise, they'd get bored. So
absolutely,
that was one thing. That we, the both of them, that both Smooth Guy and Guy, they make you think you were really a good trainer.
Right. You didn't have to do drills 5 days a week for them to progress in their training.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. So let's talk a little bit about a Smooth Guy. We know he tragically passed, and tell us his story a little bit.
About the Smooth Guy?
Yes.
Well, Smooth Guy was a really special horse. We raised him. We loved his mother. She was a beautiful mare. We'd had some brothers and sisters to him before we raised him. And so we already knew we really liked that cross. And so he come along, and he was the cutest little old buckskin colt you ever seen when he was a baby. And we thought, you know what? That colt right there deserves to stay a stud. So, which we don't leave very many of them studs here. We cut most of them. But anyway, he was so good that we just left him a stud. He was just one of them horses, kind of like a lot like his dad. He was easy to break, easy to train. He excelled real early in life. He had a lot of, I guess, charisma about him. People, when I'd take him and rope on him, people would just, I don't know how many, everybody wanted to know what he was. He drawed attention to himself because he had so much charisma, that horse.
Yes.
And he was, as a sire, an amazing, amazing horse with the race bred mares. He come along kind of at a time where the industry was needing a horse similar to him, and we got to breed him to a lot of really good race mares, and he threw so much conformation and prettiness, and he had another little air about him that was, you know, it was a lot like his dad, but it was a little different, and he threw unbelievable good looking colts. And again, you know, that a lot of different people could get along with. A lot of the amateurs rode him and done good with him, and also, you know, he showed that he could throw them really pro level horses also. And so he was just a really unique horse, and he was, the timing that he come along was perfect for him. And you know, we're extremely sad and disappointed that. His career was cut short, but you know, that's the way life goes, you know?
Yes. Well, he was so captivating, like you said, to watch move, and he just really drew your eye to him. I remember watching him and his babies. I thought he really stamped them as well.
Yeah. His babies are, you know, the same as him. He was real strong. He passed the straights on very, very strong. And you could breed him to them hotter mares and he would help. You know, he'd help the disposition and the, you know, he'd quiet down a hotter mare a little bit. His colts would be usually nicer.
Right. Let's talk about hot colors, kind of a different, you know, all race bred. Tell us how you acquired him and your favorite things about that stallion.
Okay. Yeah, we were looking for studs to breed to Debbie's good mare that year, and we picked him out as a stallion and breed her to that year. And lo and behold, we got to check it a little bit. I don't think she settled the first cycle, and so we had to call back, and we got to talking about him. And I knew Chad Hart a little bit, and I don't know how it come about, but I don't know if I asked him or if he offered him to us or whatever, but he priced him to us at a price what we thought was realistic. And we were looking for an outcross horse right there at that time anyway. So again, the timing was pretty right when we got him. We really liked, we liked all the stuff I talked about earlier about him. He was a real stout made son of special effort. He had a lot of more bone and substance than a lot of the special efforts through his female side. Again, his mare side was a great, great mare. Mm-hmm. She won like 16 races back she won multiple stakes races at his mother. And he run he run against the best racehorses that was at that time. He run at Ruidoso most all the time. He run mm-hmm. third in the Rainbow Derby himself. He always run in either stakes or allowance races. They never run him for a price. So he got tested against the best. He was extremely fast. He had 102 speed index. He ran out like 94,000 back in them days, which in them days was quite a little bit of money. And we had seen some colts out of him also that we really, really liked. So anyway, I guess that's how we ended up buying him. We did the research on him and needed him as an outcross horse, liked these colts, liked him, and was fortunate enough to get him.
So when you say outcross,
we bought him when he was 16. I think he died here on our ranch when he was 25. So he was here about 9-10 years.
So what kind of mares you said outcross, obviously going the other way from a smooth guy and Frenchman's guy probably, but what kind of mares did you like crossed on him? Was it the Frenchman's guy mares?
On Hot Colors, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, he crossed really good on the Frenchman's guy mares, smooth guy mares. A lot. We had some performance mares that we liked breeding too. And he was fine breeding to a race mare also, but that kind of wasn't what we were wanting to do. We were wanting to breed him to the Frenchman's guy daughters and the smooth guy daughters.
Right. Yeah, that's great. That's a great cross.
Really good on him.
And I know when Dale's talked about these studs, we are very, very picky about the maternal side. Mm-hmm. When he talks about a lot of these mares and what great mares these studs are out of. And that's one thing that we've always been really, really, watch for on a stud is the maternal side.
Yeah, right. We've never owned a stallion that wasn't out of a great, great mare.
Right. And, we've talked about this before. But when people are looking at stallions, like I said, a lot of people have mentioned it before, and I agree that the maternal line, that the mother of the stallion and that whole line is super important to when you're making that decision.
Yes, we really feel that way, yes.
Right. So let's talk about a little bit, everybody with social media and everything online and on the internet now, let's just talk about how much work and how much time and how much effort goes into promoting multiple stallions, multiple incentives for each stallion, all the things that go with it. And I know, Debbie, you've been a huge, huge part and partner in this. Let's just let you guys talk a little bit about how y'all's team works and how you guys get this done year after year.
Well, to start out with, we didn't have, like Bill said, we're financially pretty much strained most of the time we started out with Guy. And we're just thankful that he happened to be a horse that was very potent. And we ended up, doing our own collecting. It was all a hands-on deal at the beginning. We did, everything. And as he got, more popular and more popular and Smooth Guy got popular, pretty soon I was spending more and more time in the office. And that's kind of where I spent most of my time. And we started out, like Bill talked earlier, we had to make things work. You know, we had to pay for what we were doing. So they had to make, they had to pay our bills, and any promotion we did, we had to be able to afford that. And we started out with like quarter page ads, you know, now we do one page ads. And of course, back then they didn't have, you know, Facebook and all this other internet deals. But, well, we just, Bill mostly leaves that to me. We work together on the ads and stuff, but I think we just try, we try to do what we can with what we have to work with, you know, as far as money wise, and just gone from there.
So you guys, we talked a little bit about this earlier, just in personal conversation, but you guys never did anything else. You were passionate, each of you individually, about horses, and you went through all the, you know, rodeo and racetrack and cutting horses and all that, but your passion turned into your livelihood, right?
Right. And you know, you better have a passion for this industry, because it'll consume you. And so to us, it wasn't work, you know, we loved it. You work from sun up to sundown. We don't do that anymore because we're getting older. But back when we started out, we sure were out there. As the sun was up, we were still out there. But, you know, we didn't even think of it as work, you know, because we loved what we were doing.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure.
Absolutely. So it's gotten, like you said, a lot more, I don't know if complicated is the right word, but with Facebook, and of course, now we've got all the incentives, and you know, that's right, completely changed the industry. You know, talking to you guys, would you go back to, or would you prefer to go back to when there were just a few incentives before everything kind of started changing over, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, Bill probably can talk to you more about that, but one of the things, I feel bad for the younger kids that are starting in the industry, because it's tough, you know, just to promote a stud nowadays. I think we had a lot easier back when we were younger without any funds to back us to be able to promote Frenchman's Guy. Nowadays, it's like, I mean, we got 200,000 in incentives a year, you know?
Right.
So I did, you know, when you're, like I said, back when we started, couldn't hardly afford a page ad. So these young kids that they're wanting to get in the industry, and you see they have the passion, you know, they just want to get in there. They want to have a stud, but I just don't know how they can afford to pay all these incentives. I don't know. I'm just glad we started out when we did.
Yeah. I kind of second what Debbie says there. the industry right now is so expensive to get into, and you know, feel like you have a little bit of a level playing field with the rest of the people you're competing with, because if you're not in a lot of these incentives, it's hard for people to get interested in your horses. So it's kind of, I don't know, I guess it's a time thing, because it hasn't been going on very long, but it's really, there's been so many of them start up since the, you know, I want to say in the last 5 years. And there's good things about it for sure, because, you know, we're seeing some huge payoffs. We're seeing, you know, the tabulation of earnings for these mares and studs. If you got one that's doing good, you know, really, really skyrocket. But on the other side of it, you know, the people that starting out with these younger horses that can't be in the programs can't afford it, or for whatever reason, it really is hard for them. And I guess I ain't crazy about that part of it, that it's turned into a little bit more of a money game, per se. Mm-hmm. But you know, progress is progress. So you got to just step back and look at it in your own deal and say, you know what, this will work for me or this won't work for me. And I guess make your own decisions. It's a new wave in the barrel racing breeding business that we're all trying to try to find a happy medium, what works and what don't work with it. So I think it's a little bit early to say, you know, how it's going to affect the industry as far as long term. I think that, I guess that's probably what I'd say about it the most right there.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of different aspects to consider. And like you said, it's a little bit more of a commitment financially now, like Deb was saying, versus back when advertising wasn't such, and incentives weren't such a big part financially like they are now. If you're in those programs and do all the advertising and everything you can do, it's kind of a, you know, limitless as far as much money as you want to spend.
Right.
What about pros and cons, you know, to owning a breeding business? I know there are so many. What are some mistakes along the way that that you guys would be willing to share that you've learned from, or that, you know, really impacted your decisions after that?
Mistakes that we've made along the way? Probably, yes. We might make a whole show on just that.
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah, we learned good things from.
Oh, golly, you know, I don't know where to start on that one, because, you know, we go back and start from the beginning to through now. It's, there's just so many things that you learn along the way, you know, just different crosses, you know, breeding your stallion to different kinds of bloodlines and seeing, you know, what works and what don't work on him. And some of them, you know, you look at them after you got them on the ground and you think, man, that was not a good cross. Or he... One thing that I do think that's been good for us, but we've utilized it strongly in our program, is we ride most of our horses. So mm-hmm. you can use that as a measuring stick and basically a way to cull your own horses, because we're very strict about that kind of stuff in our own horses. So by riding them, we know their personalities. We know how they accept training. We know how mm-hmm. they move. We know all the things that are positive or negative about certain crosses. And so that has been a big tool for us to use to improve our horses, because we do the training on most of them. And so I think we learned a lot from that. We made mistakes. We crossed our studs on mares that we didn't like, that we didn't like the colts out of. But we also learned the ones that we really did like and was able to evaluate them and make some really good judgment decisions on the good ones too. So that's one thing. I mean, there's
I think another thing, and I've said this before on the young kids that are starting out, you know, trying to get a stud promoted, is, you know, back when we were starting, I mean, $300, I think, is what we started Gaia at, wasn't it, Bill? $300. And I mean, we bred anybody that had $300. they were good.
And they were good. Looking
at that, you know, pretty soon we got, you know, comments from people, oh, that the Frenchman's guys, they can't run fast enough, or, you know, and I'm thinking, yeah, some of them probably couldn't, because I mean, when you bred what we bred to anything and everything, and that's right. Probably thinking that we needed to, because we needed the money. But thinking back, I'm thinking now it would have been better if we would have been a little more selective at the beginning, mm-hmm. because they come out in 3 or 4 years, and that's what's showing your horse, your stud, is those colts out there competing. It's like, yeah, that was probably not a good idea. So even though you really financially think it's a good idea, sometimes it's better financially in the long run not to do something like that.
Right. Yeah, it's almost like a double. Selective. Yes, more selective. I'm sorry, Bill. Go ahead.
No, I say being a little more selective when you first start out breeding your horse, because, like Debbie said, it can work against you.
And another thing I might add is when you start out a young horse, you don't charge very much, like we charged 300 and went up, you know, gradually. But I did find out through the long term that we've been in this, is it seems like if you don't charge very much for your stud fee, they don't take quite as good a care of that colt, and maybe not even the, you know, they'll bring you a better mare, and they'll be more apt to be, you know, want to get something done with that colt.
Right.
So yeah. Having a really cheap stud fee isn't necessarily the best thing either.
Yeah, that's very
and
good advice.
Bill's, I know Bill's always said, you know, if you value your stud, you know, put him up there where you think he's, you know, where he's worth something. Don't, you know, put some value on him if you value him.
Yeah, don't be Absolutely. Ashamed to, if you don't like your own horse, well, why would you think anybody else would? So I really think that a lot of people start their studs out a little too cheap, and the people that look at him and say, well, jeepers, they're only charging $500 to breed to that horse. A lot of people think, well, he must not be much of a horse, you know.
I'm not going to give him my best mare.
I'm not going to breed my best mare to that horse because, you know, he must not be that good a horse. They only charge $500 to feed. That's just the number. It could be $300 or whatever. But I do think that your stud fee really dictates the quality of mare you get to your horse. And also, as we, with Frenchman's Guy, I don't know, our timing was seemed to be right all the time, but as we went up with the stud fees on him, you know, whenever we decided to go up, we always got a better class mare to breed to him, and his babies always, the value of them went up all the time. As his stud fee went up, the value of his babies went up, because they had a starting spot there, say, you know, back when we were 1,500, 3,000. That's where these colts would start when you'd sell one of them. You know, the stud fee on him is 3,000. Well, they got to start him at 3,000. So if you have a very cheap stud fee there, you know, you don't have no value to start the value of your colt. And it does not help your value of your colt.
That's a very good point. I never really thought about the stud fee in relation to starting a colt at that price.
You got to be able to justify that by, like, his colt's got to be doing something. So, like, if you got a stud that's not producing, well, yeah, it's pretty hard to go up. But if you're watching your stud's colts and they're winning, as they get popularity, as that popularity starts to grow and they start winning more, then the public don't have a problem with you raising your stud fee.
Right. Oh no, not at all. Yeah. And like you said, it pays dividends, because then you get better mares when you raise your stud fee, and then the colts are in better hands, and then it all just goes hand in hand.
Yeah, it's very, and you know, you can still give somebody a discount if you want, or you get a better mare, or you got a kid that you want to help out, or whatever. You can still help people out by you know, giving them a better deal here and there along the way.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I think we should definitely do a second episode, but I wanted to touch on just and say congratulations to you guys about Morning Traffic and Martini, and what a phenomenal year she's had with Michelle Darling this year. And you guys talk a little bit about her.
Yeah, she's something else up there. She sold through our sale, you know, when she was a two-year-old. Lance Robinson, of course, brought her to the sale. And did you say you wanted to talk about her, or later do that at a later time?
Yes. No, go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. You know, Lance, he had some really nice mares, and he was kind of an early player in the people that picked out Frenchman's Guy as a stallion. And he bought some real nice bred quarter horse mares and bred them kind of exclusively to Frenchman's Guy at that time. And he sold horses through our sale, which I guess that's another thing we didn't talk about when we started our sale and stuff about that. But Traffic Guy went through our sale. You know, we've had some BHR Frenchie Socks, Frenchman's Fabulous. We've had some superstar horses went through our sale. And she was just happened to be one of them, you know. And then, of course, Michelle bought him right there through the sale, and it's kind of been a success story ever since. She's just done a wonderful job with her. And she let Stevie Hillman ride her a little bit there the first year, I think. And Stevie won Pendleton on her and won Big on her. And then Michelle's kind of rode her ever since. And gosh, she's won so much stuff. And so it's really cool. She's such a nice lady. You really like to see people like that win, you know. And so it's rewarding to us to get to watch her. It's really, really a neat thing to be able to see them horses excel at that level and just keep track of them, you know.
Right. And I know there's so many now that are so successful. You know, you mentioned a handful right there, but talk a minute about, you know, breeding, a breeding business and stallions and things like that. It's such a long process. You know, you're talking about young stallions and the money you have to put up for them to be in these programs before their colts can ever run. I mean, it's a long process, and it's not for everyone, especially if you're not passionate about the horses, is it?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's something that I guess that's, you got to have a lot of patience to be successful, I think, as a long-term breeder. A lot of people don't have that kind of patience, and they think it's going to happen overnight, and it just does not happen overnight. You kind of got to have thick skin. You got to start out, and like I said about the young horses, trying to wait till their babies are old enough, you know, that takes a lot of time, and you know, you got to try the different crosses, and you got to promote in the meantime, which costs you a lot of money, and it's kind of like going to Vegas. I mean, there's a lot of gamble, and the tough part of it is you know you might gamble 4 or 5 years to find out, and you might not. It takes 4 or 5 years at least to find out whether your horse is going to produce. And then you still just kind of barely know. So you got to gamble 4 or 5 years of that horse's life. So, for example, if you don't make it, well, then you got to start all over with another one. And so that's the tough about the stallion business is you just, there's no overnight success in it. You got to start. You got to do your due diligence. You got to try to do a jillion things. You got to try to promote. You got to try to find the best mares. If you don't own them, you need to go try to make deals with people to breed their mares. You got to wait. You got to have a lot of patience to be in the breeding business. It don't matter whether it's the barrel. It's probably a little more of the barrel business than some of them. You know, your racehorses they're going to the racetrack when they're 2 years old. Cutting horses, most of them are showed by the time they're 3 in the fraternities. So the barrel horse business is you know, you got to hang on to them longer. It's see whether they're going to make it or not. And it's really a waiting game, and you got to have patience. You can't get in and out. Like a lot of people get in and out thinking that it's just going to be easy and quick, and it's just not.
No, and, you know, those first few years, you know, that you are actually breeding mares and you're trying to get good mares, you know, your foal crops are not real big those first few years, probably, on average. So then, you know, you're battling the numbers, and, you know, half of them sometimes get hurt or don't make, you know, things happen. So it's a long process, and it requires a lot of patience, like you said.
Yeah. From breeding the mare to waiting till it's being competed on. There's so many things can happen. You know, they can get hurt so easy. Some of them just don't have the right talent. Some of them have conformation flaws. If a young stallion starts out and breeds, let's just say 20 mares, he'll be lucky if 5 of them make it to the old enough to compete on. So you got a real small number of chances for that stallion's colt to really make it, because so many things happen along the way there that work against, you know, that horse having a number of colts go to the arena the first time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, really kind of something that you don't think about until you own a stallion. You think, well, they bred X amount of mares. Well, that doesn't mean that many colts are going to be in the futurity pen in 4 years.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's been so great having you guys on. Just so much history and information, and we're just so blessed to have had y'all on tonight. I'd love to get you guys back maybe next week for episode 2. And just want to say congratulations on everything, all the stallions, all the success, and it's been a real pleasure having you guys tonight.
We thank you very much. God has been very good to us. We're very blessed people.